After leaving the others to dwell on Winslow's field notes, I decided to swing over to Westwood and check in on Lucy and Eddie. I understood from my contacts in the LAPD that gangland had gone to ground, and that my former colleagues were doing the rounds and reminding those recidivists to stay home and out of the way. It was about an hour after sunset when I rode up to the apartment complex where Lucy had her pad, and I could immediately tell the place was under surveillance. There was a dark car parked across the street, with the engine still running, and I could see the red blossom of the end of the driver's cigarette. I decided to park a bit further down the block and see if I could clock who it was. I headed up the street and crouch-ran the last few meters, using other cars for cover. The driver was definitely one of the Stafakis brothers, I think the younger one, Yanis. Whilst I was deciding what to do, I heard a muffled gunshot and a scream come from the apartments, and I decided there was no time to lose. As Yanis got out of the car, I sapped him. Two swift whacks behind the ear, and he was down and out. I drew my .38 and ran across the street. Light was pouring from the open door of Lucy's apartment, and I heard her crying and begging for her life. I moved swiftly but quietly to the door and peeked inside. Eddie was splayed out shirtless on the sofa, and Lucy was in her dressing gown and on her knees in front of Tommy Stafakis, who had a fist of her hair in one hand and a cutthroat razor in the other. Time slowed down, and I knew I only had seconds to act. Tommy yanked Lucy towards him, and I thought he was going to slit her throat, so I shouted a warning but pulled the trigger at the same time. I put two rounds straight into Tommy's chest, and he went down, letting go of both Lucy and the razor at the same time. Lucy scrambled over to Eddie, who was moaning. I quickly checked the kid, but he was just sporting a black eye and a sore jaw. He said Tommy had sucker-punched him when he went to answer the door. He got off a shot, but it had gone wide. I could hear sirens, so I told him to split, whilst I looked after Lucy and explained things to the cops. The two kids kissed each other, and then Eddie was gone. Tommy wasn't gone, but he was breathing the kind of pink bubbles that told me I had pierced a lung. I decided to spare his life and propped him up so he didn't drown in his own blood before the paramedics arrived. I cooled my heels in the local PD while statements were taken, and I played the Good Samaritan card. You know, just happened to be in the neighborhood when I heard a scream and intervened. Mal Considine came round to stand up for me, and as Lucy backed the story and Tommy was in surgery, I was kicked loose again in the early hours. I drove Lucy to a hotel near Michael's office and told her to stay put for a while. In the morning, Eddie called me to say thanks, and that he'd spoken to Johnny Stampinato, was willing to send a couple of guys to watch over Lucy. I said it couldn't hurt, but to let Lucy decide. Apparently Eddie had been told to steer clear of Audrey Anders, as she'd been dumped by Mickey Cohen for reasons best known to Mickey. Later that morning, Ari Geller called and asked for an update. I said we were making progress and were only hours behind Susan Wilton. He said we should let Laura Swan know that, and that she and Nathan Archer were now back from sailing in San Diego. I called Michael, who said he'd see if he could reach her, and sure enough, later that day, he did, and she agreed to an early evening meeting at her home. Roger spent the afternoon at the museum and picked up some more useful information. First from Charlie Bass in the Oriental section. Bass had managed to contact Schmidt, who agreed to speak to us, and Charlie passed his number over. Michael called later that day, and an elderly-sounding woman with barking dogs around her agreed that he would meet us tomorrow night. We were to call at his home in Pasadena on Friday. That evening, Michael went to see Laura Swan, whilst I checked in on Lucy and then Eddie. Both were fine, if a little shaken. No one was reassured by the news that Tommy Stafakis was still kicking. Michael's meeting with Laura was interesting, only in the sense that Katz got to see a different side of her. She was openly hostile to Nathan Archer directly in front of him. It looked like all was not well in that relationship, and Nathan stormed out. Katz did get a commitment from Miss Swan that she would return to the set on the following Monday, if we had knowledge of where Susan was by that point in time. Katz may have let slip some innuendo about her and Susan being more than just employer and employee, which apparently set her on edge. Then he dropped the harvester's word and got himself thrown out by the butler. One thing Lara did say was that she had been sailing as guests of Armand and Anastasia Wolfe, whose party she was attending in Malibu on Friday night. Thinking there can't be that many high-profile Malibu parties, I guess this was where John Baldwin would be escorting Miss Allison, or rather Mrs. Powell, to. Lucky guy. Well, maybe, maybe not. Friday rolled around, and while some were focused on the events of the evening, there was still lots to do during the day. Roger spent the day at the museum and managed to find Jonesy, who'd moved the statue around for Winslow. Jonesy was a maintenance guy whose tongue was loosened by a handful of dead presidents of the $20 variety. He talked about Winslow being squirrely as shit. He and a friend had been paid $500 to move stuff around that Director Heaton was not supposed to know about. They moved it to the reserve section. It was weird. They put it in an out-of-the-way spot. Winslow said he'd put it in Alameda, and then it showed up here and freaked out. It arrived in a box, but it ended up unboxed. Jonesy had no idea how that had happened, but was quite willing to comment on the decline of Winslow's mental state. Back in his office, Roger took a call from Oliver, the orderly at Winslow's sanitarium. He had news of an odd group who'd visited Dr. Winslow. Five men, one of whom seemed to fit the description of the man who had paralyzed Roger. The others apparently looked Japanese. They insisted on seeing Winslow alone and pushed Oliver out. They were in there for just 10 minutes and then marched out. Winslow's state was unchanged. They said they were friends from overseas. Meanwhile, Katz had been trying to track down the Pacific oil engineer Pat O'Malley, who had been with Winslow in the Andaman Islands. After a lot of phone time, he established that O'Malley no longer worked for Pacific and had resigned after getting hurt in the Andamans. He was convalescing until early 1949, when he was discharged from a Bangkok hospital. They had his last address as being in the U.S., but he was an international operator, so really could be anywhere. Roger had been having a similar runaround, trying to find the archaeologists named in Winslow's notes. They were all on the wind, and that sure seemed odd. So, as darkness fell, John Baldwin donned the penguin suit and headed off to collect June, while the rest of us headed off to Pasadena to meet Schmidt. Roger had got Charlie to spill the beans that Schmidt was some kind of an ex-cop, but was also versed in experimental science and the occult. It would be a night of strange revelations, from which none of us would emerge unchanged.